You can hit it or hit it.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Capitol and to the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection. Beautiful Friday afternoon. We're going to have some really good testimony on some important bills. It's going to be clear and concise testimony. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 4111. Representative, thank you. Would you introduce yourself and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and co-chairs. State Representative Jim Widener, representing primarily Yamhill County and now left Polk County and moving into Washington County next session. So what I bring to you today is House Bill 4111, and this is a bill that we've been working on that was here last session that Senator Floyd Prezansky had introduced, and it kind of got held up on some other issues, and we are working with Mr. Honeycutt here on bringing this bill to you. When we started going through the laws the other day, we noticed some problems with it, but essentially this changes the procedure for local governments to sell land tracts and any improvements to enforce unpaid liens on final assessment of properties. So basically, someone who owns a piece of ground, they may be land rich and pocket poor, and the city, county, state comes in and does an improvement in front of the house, puts in sidewalks, sewer, and everything, and then they basically say, here's your bill for $7,000. They don't have the $7,000 to pay it. They put a lien on it, and they sell the property for the $7,000, and the property owner is left kind of high and dry at that point because they weren't able to come up with money to pay for the lien. So that's where this bill came about. We're working on some amendments. We noticed some other problems in statute after working with some people, and I'll let Mr. Honeycutt kind of go over that with you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnik, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 4111. The purpose of this bill is to deal with lien foreclosures arising from local improvement districts. When a local improvement district is formed typically for infrastructure improvements, sidewalks, street improvements, something of that nature, the district is formed and each of the properties that are within that district are assessed a portion of the cost of the local improvement district, and the assessment goes to the property and not to the individual. If that assessment is then not paid, then the district has the ability to foreclose on the lien. And under the current law, and the operative section of this particular bill is Section 3. Under the current law, which is ORS 223.525, if the lien is foreclosed, the district, or in many cases the city that's foreclosing on the lien, cannot accept a bid for the property that exceeds the amount of the lien. And so you have a $7,000 lien for sidewalk improvements. The property owner doesn't have the $7,000. The city forecloses on the lien at the auction to sell the property. The city cannot accept a bid that exceeds the amount of the lien. The fact pattern that gave rise to this bill, it happened quite some time ago. This bill has been was introduced like 20 years ago, but the fact pattern that gave rise to this bill arose out of the city of Eugene, where the city of Eugene formed an LID for sidewalk improvements. A brother and sister who had owned a home in the city of Eugene, free and clear, were elderly. The city foreclosed, or the city, they didn't have the money to pay the assessment. The LID was formed over their opposition. Sidewalks were put in. Their property was assessed. Their property was free and clear. They owned their home and got Social Security received Social Security, and that's what they lived on. When they couldn't pay the $7,000 assessment, the city foreclosed on the property. And by statute, the city may not have been the bad guy in this particular situation, because by statute, the city couldn't sell the property for any more than the amount of the lien. And essentially what happened then was somebody came in, offered the lien, the city accepted the offer, and that person then took over the property, and this elderly brother and sister lost their home that they owned free and clear. The House Bill 4111 in its current form fixes that. There are amendments that we are preparing for this bill. I know we're on a short time, so we're trying to get those amendments done quickly. And there's an additional set of amendments that the land and title folks and the realtors want unrelated to this particular section of the bill apparently have no opposition. And so there may be, hopefully there'll be one universal set of amendments that solve this, that correct some of the flaws with the bill as currently proposed, and add a little bit for the to deal with another issue that the realtors and the land and title folks have.
Mr. Tunnicutt, have you submitted the amendments yet? Have they been drafted?
We have. We're working with Ledge Council. Representative Widener and I are working with Ledge Council now on those.
Okay, thank you very much. Committee members, questions of this panel? So, no questions. Thank you. So, what you're saying is that the current law does not allow you to sell the property for higher than the bill for the sidewalk.
Well, when there's a foreclosure on the lien, whatever the assessment is, and the city or the district forecloses on the lien, the city or the district cannot accept more than the amount of the assessment. In that case, it was a $7,000 lien. They couldn't accept more than $7,000. Now, were they able to accept a higher amount? And were there a competitive bidding process where you had more than one person that was interested pursuing the auction, then whatever amount was over and above the lien would then go to any subsequent lien holders, a mortgage company or whatever, and anything over and above that would have gone to the property owner. So in that situation, since they owned the property free and clear, anything above $7,000 would have gone to the property owner and at least given them the ability to recoup some of the equity that they had spent years building up in the property.
And the thing we ran into while we were investigating this is people who don't own their property free and clear, where a bank has a note on it, they go in and buy up the lien, and then if it's in a foreclosure, it would go to auction and then sell for more. So it's almost better to carry debt on your house than not have the debt, because you had some protection from the bank. So if they would have had a $10,000 loan on the property, the bank probably would have absorbed that and then bought off the lien, went to auction, sold it, and they still would have been made whole. But the fact is they own the property outright and got hurt for it. So, and
thank
this
you.
There's a whole bunch of little issues we started finding in statute that needed to be cleaned up when we sat down with Harrison at LC and started working on this.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward. We have Co-Chair Hovey.
I'm curious, because this bill came forward before, and it seems sort of straightforward in your explanation. And who opposes this concept? Is there opposition to this anywhere?
Well, League of Oregon Cities.
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby, I believe the opposition, and I think there's folks from the league here that will testify in opposition to this bill.
Oh, well, maybe we'll get a chance to hear from them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll ask Ms. O'Day. Is it Ms. O'Day? G.
Mr.
Mistress.
Sean O'Day.
Oh, I saw the J. Gene. Excuse me, Sean. Identify yourself, please. Welcome, and give us your testimony, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, I am Sean O'Day. I'm the General Counsel for the League of Oregon Cities. We understand that this bill, that the principal focus is to preserve equity. And just to get it out there at the beginning, we have no desire to see that individuals lose their equity in their homes. The situation that you just heard about is certainly an unfortunate set of circumstances. What our interest is ensuring a fair and expedient process for the lien foreclosure on a municipal lien, particularly where that local government has gone forward and expended public funds to produce public improvement. the current draft causes us concerns because the process that it sets out complicates the foreclosure process, adds a little bit of time, and in some circumstances could lead to an indefinite resolution of that lien, or the foreclosure of that lien. However, as you've just heard, we understand that amendments are in the works. Our representative, Mr. Scott Winkles, is working with others to work out those procedural matters, and we look forward to doing so and hopefully presenting this committee with a bill that equitably balances the interests of the consumer along with a fair and efficient foreclosure process.
Thank you. Committee members, questions, Mr. O'Day?
Are there any amendments that you're working on going forward? I was going to comment and ask you about your tan. I mean, you look like you, and I realize I don't know if I really want to do that, but then I just have. Are you guys been talking about amendments? Do you think this is something we should just wait until all the way, or do you think there's something that could be done the next few days?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Smith, we do think that there's some things that can be done to get this worked out. Again, our primary concerns with the way that the bill was drafted was that it had a tiered sale schedule in it that required that the property first be put out to bid and that it must be sold at the fair market value. And if it doesn't sell then within the next 180 days, it would be sold at no less than 90% of its value, and then if not sold then, at 80% of its value. And then if it didn't sell it after that, then the foreclosure just didn't go forward. I understand that the amendments through my discussions with Mr. Winkles really gets at the heart of that process, which is our primary concern right now. So I think if that gets resolved, that we can move forward with a bill in the next couple of days that I think everybody would be happy with.
Other questions, committee members? Mr. Day, thank you very much for your testimony. I think a problem has been identified here. I think it's up to us to help the citizens correct this, and I hope you and the legal work with Mr. Honeycutt and Representative Wyden to come up with a quick amendments, and because time is of the essence for this short session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Premier, just real quick for the record, the amendments that we're working on actually are one that would take it straight to, there's two different ones we're working on, but it would basically speed up the process where they could go. They just need to kind of follow the procedures that the sheriffs have to do when they are on a foreclosure and advertise it to make sure enough people show up to bid on the property. So that's what we're addressing in the amendments.
Very good. Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, committee members, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4111. They didn't show up yet still?
They're not here.
No.
Do you want to go to the vacancy bill?
Okay, are we gonna be ready to move that, Paul?
Which one?
The vacancy bill.
Okay, we're going to open up.
Do you want to hear from George Lawton?
Okay, yeah, let's have him come up just to be sure.
Okay.
Unless you want to go to the public hearing first on the.
Yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do a public hearing.
He's in the hallway. Let me go grab him.
Okay. Okay, committee members and public, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4114. Delaying a moment as our witness is out outside is going to come in. Still there? Okay, good. Sir, would you come on up, Mr. Notton?
Yes, sir.
Notton. Jen, you want to remind the committee members of 4114? We've had hearing.
I will. This is the bill that it prohibits a state agency from retaining and filling a long-term vacant position if the director of the Department of Administrative Services determines that the reasons the agency provides are insufficient. And it requires the director to report quarterly to the Senate President, House Speaker, and the Legislative Assembly.
Thank
There's
you.
No revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the bill.
Thank you. Sir, you want to identify yourself and address this very briefly.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton, the Administrative Budget and Management Division within the Department of Administrative Services. This committee, during the last legislative session and during the interim, has had several conversations around this issue. There is currently reporting that happens on a quarterly basis with Legislative Fiscal Office related to long-term vacancies. It is one of the budget processes that we certainly are managing vacancies right now. Agency leadership inside the executive branch is monitoring vacancies very closely, especially in this tight budget time frame. We, I believe, are neutral on the bill, have not provided for or against on this topic, but I'm certainly available to answer questions if there are some.
Thank you. Committee members, questions? Co-chair, help me.
Yeah, thank you, and I'm not sure whether you're the correct one to answer this. Maybe Legislative Council is, but in the bill, Section 1, on the first page on line 23, Section 1, Sub 2, Sub C, I'm curious if that particular line actually is giving legislative authority to the executive branch of government.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I probably am not the right person to answer that question about the legality of and separation of powers questions. I would probably defer to Legislative Council on that one.
Mr. Chair, what was that line again?
That's line 23.
Of?
That subsection C of the first page.
I think, committee members, we heard this. We moved this bill out of committee last session, and I think Legislative Council, you know, addressed this. We were concerned, Representative Hovey, he had a good concern about the constitutionality, and I thought that was addressed, and it's here. As Mr. Naughton said, the co-chair's last session, remember, did eliminate 500 vacant positions in their review, but I think we had a lot more vacant positions that were there. Some of them are justified, and this bill does give the agencies the right to argue their case of why they're keeping it vacant. We know that a lot of those vacant positions are for seasonal workers, and that's the justification would be adequate to satisfy the legislative oversight, I believe. We didn't ask for the council to come in. That's all.
Well, you know, this was the one issue that I flagged for you that I was a little bit concerned about, Mr. Co-Chair. I just don't have a great deal of angst, but I am concerned about the ability of the director to not fill a position that the legislature has authorized and budgeted and directed them to do. And so, I mean, that's my concern now that the agency can, according to this, can not follow through with what the legislature has already told them to do in the budget. So I'm just wondering about whether or not that crosses the line of constitutional authority.
Okay. No other questions of this witness? Okay. No other testimony? Then we'll close the public hearing on 4114. I don't mind keeping it open, but just need to move it. I think it's the same issue.
Yeah. Well, actually, this is a different part. I didn't, you know, I thought we could, I don't have a problem moving, but I'd like to get that clarification before we do. Okay. If we can get Charlie Cheeks or whoever to, if it doesn't cross the line, I'm fine.
Okay. No, 4115.
Yeah.
We're just going to carry over. We already had the hearing, though, as a work session.
We haven't had the hearing yet.
Okay.
And there's people here to testify on that, too.
There are people who signed up to 4115. Okay, committee members, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4115. Jen, please give us a brief summary of the bill.
Mr. Chairs, House Bill 4115 requires the Secretary of State to audit certain contracts for construction. It requires a contracting agency to pay a fee that's equal to 0.1% of the construction contract price. And the fees are paid into an audit account that's going to be used by the Secretary of State to meet the expenses of conducting those audits. It requires the Secretary of State to publish a report on each audit on its website and on the Oregon Transparency website. It declares an emergency effective on passage. We have testimony that was submitted by two people who weren't able to attend. Brenda Wilson from the City of Eugene has submitted testimony in opposition, and Mark Landauer, representing Special Districts Association, has submitted testimony in opposition of the bill.
Okay, and we do have a dash one on this, right?
The dash one amendment was adopted on Wednesday, and that was the amendment that set a cap on the fee of $7,500 per contract and a minimum fee of $250 per contract. It also sunset the collection of the fee on July 2017.
Thank you. So who's our first? Who's going to testify?
Wow.
Okay. Let's get people that are going to want it for it.
Yeah. Krieg and Daryl Fuller.
Mr. Krieg and Mr. Fuller, please, would you come up and testify? Daryl Fuller?
Yep.
We have a lot of absentees today.
Good afternoon. Thank you. You got the right one?
Co-Chair Wisnett and Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg, here representing the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, also the Sheet Metal Workers Local 16. Mr. Fuller is in another meeting. I sent him a note saying this is up now, so he should be scurrying down. Our organizations were in support of this concept during the previous session. This issue has come up before. Representative Holvey has put this forward in the past. Our contractors have had difficulties with some of our government contracts over the years, and the reasons behind them will vary each time. The circumstances vary quite often. There's a growing frustration with this and the fact that the rules sometimes get bent or forgotten, but there's also the issue you can't fight City Hall. In many cases, one of my contractors will have kind of an ongoing relationship with a government entity where they may do work off and on for them for many years, and so there's a question of how far do you want to push it. Situation when you think something has been handled a little bit oddly. I think the concept of going in and doing some audits and having some clarity out there and also the ability to go and look when we feel that something is rotten in Denmark and looking into it would be a big help in the long haul. So in general, the concept of this we're very interested and supportive of, and we think the cap ideas on it were probably a very good idea to add to the bill to make it more palatable for all.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions of Mr. Krieg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krieg, so you know you've alluded to some of the issues. Is there, you can't fight City Hall, and you know, just reading between the lines, what is I suppose the remedy for holding a contracting agency or questioning whether or not they're following the contracting laws? Is there any sort of oversight or any sort of method for resolution to somebody who thinks that the contracting agency is not following the law?
Frankly, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, frankly, at this point, that's always very difficult to try to pursue. And each government entity with different structures within it can make that more challenging. So we really don't have a clear and easy method to do it, and it's very expensive to go and do that. So if a contractor loses a bid or they see something that happens with a contract that they thought was going one way, but then they're seeing and how it's actually implemented going a very different way, there's just not a very, there's no inexpensive way to talk about it. There's no easy way or solution to have it looked at this point. They ask, we get these questions occasionally in the trade associations, and we kind of look at it and we think about, okay, how would we go about that? And usually we end up saying, it's probably not worth, on the one hand, rocking the boat or expending the precious resources to address it in that way. And that's very frustrating for our contractors.
Thank you.
Any other questions, committee members? Mr. Fuller didn't make it yet. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Krieg. We'll we got also the guy, gentleman here from Eugene. I hate to.
We won't take very long to get Charlie up on your first bill.
Okay. Okay, committee members and public, we have a witness that we want to testify on a previous bill, so we're going to close, suspend, close that. Our administrator left.
You can close and reopen it.
Be sure I'm using the right term.
Close.
House Bill 4115, public hearing, we're going to close. We're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4114. Mr. Cheeks, you came in, I believe, Legislative Council. He left us again. Mr. Cheeks is here, Jan. We closed this, going to reopen it. Okay. Where's Mr. Cheeks? Here he comes. Charlie, would you come up, please, sir? Thank you for being here. I'm sorry.
So you're reopening?
Yeah, I'm going to close that too. So we've got 114 reopened.
Okay.
Just identify yourself, please, sir. Thank you for being here. And Co-Chair Hovey had a question, I think, for you, sir.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairs Wisnett and Colvey. I'm Charlie Cheek from Legislative Council.
And thank you for showing up and clarifying, because we went through this last session. I just wanted to be clear. I think we addressed the issue of giving legislative authority to the executive branch in terms of not filling a position that the legislature has authorized for a purpose.
Right.
And that was in, I think, line 23 through 25 of the bill. That I just wanted to, I guess, a brief statement that we're not crossing the line as far as giving legislative authority to the executive branch.
Okay, there were a couple of constitutional issues as the concept was developed. The first one was whether or not this kind of action could be taken by the executive branch in relationship to the judiciary branch and the legislative branch. And the conclusion was that raised constitutional issues of delegation and authority. And so that this bill does not allow for that. This only applies to executive branch agencies. Okay, the second part of your question is that this bill deals with unfilled positions is through the current allotment system, which currently allows or requires a quarterly review of allotments. And if the way this bill works is if there's money allotted for a position, the position is not filled under current statutes, that allotment comes back into, it can be withdrawn and goes back into the general fund.
Okay.
So it doesn't really change that. What the bill did do is change the definition of agencies that are affected by that process. Hopefully that clarified that for you.
Thank you, sir.
For me. Thank you.
You okay?
Yep.
Okay, thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Yes, sir.
So can we do a work session on it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4114. Committee members, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4114 and ask for a vote on moving House Bill 4114.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4114 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the referral to the Ways and Means Committee by prayer reference.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hovey moves House Bill 4114 to the floor of a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Comments, questions, committee members? Do a roll call vote, please. Representative Widener.
Well, I guess we'll find out in Ways and Means or they'll deal with the budgetary impacts on this, but I'm still
coming back into the committee and wasn't here last time, not totally up to speed with all of it on it, so.
Yeah. Okay, roll call, please.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Clem. Representative Matthews.
Excused.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Excused.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye.
Co-Chair Whitman.
Aye. Bill passes. So we don't need this. Goes to Ways and Means Service. We don't do it at
no
floor.
Carrier,
yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much. And committee members, we did have a gentleman from out of
that work session.
Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4115.
4114.
And we're going to go back. We have a gentleman that did I do the wrong one?
4114.
All right, 4114. We're going to go back to 4111. We have a gentleman from out of the area that wanted to testify. Mr. Scott, is it Roter?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming. And please welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your concise testimony. And I understand.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for letting me do so. I tried very hard to get here on time. And I apologize for being late. My name is Scott Roter. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4111.
Go ahead.
One of our famous presidents said, if you want to make enemies, just try to change the status quo. Anybody know who said that? Because I was trying to figure out. I didn't have my website with me on the way up here. But for too many years, this law, ORS 223525, has been the law in Oregon. It's long past time to revise it. Jack and Betty Neely say it's 15 years past time to revise it. That's how long it's been since I first wrote House Bill 3453 to change this horrible situation in which, for a government purpose, to satisfy a government lien, any government, well, especially city or county, can come around and sell their property for the exact amount and not to exceed that amount of an unpaid lien. Betty and I have been waiting 15 years for this necessary reform to pass the House and the Senate and become law. And Jack has been dead for exactly that amount of time, because that's what happened to him 1 month after they did this to him. Sold his house for the exact amount of a sewer lien, which years later the Oregon Appellate Court said was illegal. No, that's not the issue here. The issue is we need to fix this law that allows this to happen. And Betty would say the same thing. She's no longer living in Oregon. On my way up here, I realized that this bill, that this law, 223525, it not only violates one of our Bill of Rights amendments, the fifth, which says property shall not be taken for a public purpose without just compensation, and by that the founders weren't talking about just barely or not at all. It also violates the fourth, because we all have a right to be secure in our homes as well as our persons and effects from unreasonable seizures. And it also violates the eighth, which says excessive punishment or fines shall not be imposed. Cruel and unusual punishment, excessive fines shall not be imposed. These folks were fined $65,000 for a $5,000 sewer bill. And subsequently, after a five-year legal battle, Jack Neely died of a heart attack precipitated by stress over that battle. So that's the prelude. I have some brief remarks. There's already an attempt to undermine under this bill with some amendments so that property to be foreclosed on can be sold to just the highest bidder with no minimum bids. The League of Cities seems to be behind that unholy position. Just how would that work? Let's say the house was $70,000 assessed at, and the lien was for $7,000, which was the case here. If the highest bid on the property was $5,000, would that be enough to sell the property? Probably not. Because the same cities that are against this bill, probably primarily Portland, would probably want all of their money. Wouldn't you? I would. I don't even blame them for wanting their money, all of it. As long as the lien is valid and they're entitled to it. But by the same token, the property owner is also entitled to all of the money that he has invested in his property. That is beyond the actual value of the lien or liens against it. At least if property rights are to actually mean something anymore. I also agree with that. Wouldn't you? In the process of perfecting a lien, no government should be able to sell, transfer, or should I say, steal a property owner's valid legal investment in their property. It's an even more egregious assault on the Bill of Rights when the property that's being foreclosed on is an owner-occupied residence. And the owner is put out on the streets and caused to become homeless over it. It's even worse when he's a senior citizen, 76 years old, and all of these things did happen. And what would you say if I told you, well, you already know, that he died of a heart attack, induced by a five-year-long legal battle with the city of Eugene and that Lane County Courts and the Sheriff's Department piled in at the very end? Is there one of you that's not moved by this story? Then do something to fix this. This law, 523.525, and others like it, so that this doesn't happen anyone to anyone else ever again in our state. The government's only legitimate interest in such properties is their valid lien against it. The law is about providing equal justice to everybody. Lest it should be said that the umbrella of the law just ain't big enough for everybody to fit under it. I'm so tired of being treated like a second-class citizen in my own country, by my own government, and having politicians ruling over us who don't have common sense or moral compass. I'm sure that Jack Neely went to his grave feeling totally disillusioned and discouraged with his country. Whether it's the Patriot Act, or the National Defense Authorization Act, or just the act of taking somebody's property without just compensation for a public purpose, which is to satisfy that lien, which is where that money went to go, to provide public services. And by that, well, I've already said this, I won't repeat it, but Jack Neely's dead bones are crying out from the grave right now for justice. And I don't want to believe I'm the only one that's hearing it and hearing him. And I'm here to tell you, not in my name.
Thank you very much for your strong and compassionate testimony. Any questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just would like to say thanks for your testimony today, sir. Really appreciate your voice on this. It was Woodrow Wilson. I happened to Google that for you really quick. So
I thought it might have been him or Franklin Roosevelt.
And as I say this, again, very compelling testimony. You also quoted Edmund Burke in your written testimony. And he also said, all that's necessary for the force of evil to win is for enough few good men to do nothing. Thanks for doing something. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your testimony.
And you too, Mr.
Thank you very much for coming up. Safe travels, and we're going to correct this.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, with that testimony, then we'll reclose the public hearing on 4111, and we'll go back, committee members and the public, to House Bill 4115, open that up, and we'll ask Mike Ellison, and Brian Smith, and Randy Tucker, or I guess we could do... Randy, why don't you wait and you come up with Lori so she won't be by herself. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for being here. I appreciate, please provide us, identify yourself and provide us your concise testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 4115. Because this has been before you before, I'll be brief in my comments. First of all, counties take their responsibility to be wise stewards of public funds seriously. We already do perform yearly audits that are to standards specified by the Secretary of State's Audits Division. We pay a municipal audit assessment to the Secretary of State already for them to certify that our audits are done according to state standards. Even with the amended version to this bill, capping the fee at $7,500. I took a look at a report of all the public contracts that counties entered into during the 2009-10 fiscal year. And it was actually only a partial report. It was missing several large counties. But even with that, the fee that we would be paying would be well over $250,000. And in this time of shrinking budgets, I don't believe that's a fee that we can afford to pay. And finally, there's a public contracting work group that's been directed by the legislature to meet during the interim, during this particular interim, to look at whether any changes need to be made to ORS Chapter 279. And we would suggest that maybe we let that group play out, do their work, and see if there are any suggestions that come back for 2013. But thank you for the time. I'm certainly willing to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mike. Mr. Smith, why don't you give us yours first?
Thank you for this opportunity, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, representatives. My name is Brian Smith. I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County, and I'd like to speak just briefly to the impact of this on Multnomah County. We have approximately 75 contracts that would be subject to this tax, and it would likely add tens of thousands of dollars to our project costs annually. And right now, I've been working with our facilities folks, and they're looking at what are they not going to be able to do on their budgets for next year. And this would certainly impact those kinds of decisions. Additionally, as I review this legislation, there's no guarantee of service even paying those fees. And the construction, the public works contracts that we already do are already subject to audit from both our elected auditor as well as external auditors. So I would like to testify against this measure today.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions for these witnesses? No questions? Very good. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we have Mr. Tucker and Satinspiel. Mrs. Satinspiel. Randy, I got the Wilson quote before.
I got scooped by Representative Matthews.
Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm having distributed right now by Sue some testimony from our elected auditor, Suzanne Flynn. The long and the short of it is that we have an independently elected auditor already who conducts a number of audits throughout the year, which you can look up on our website and see the entire list, as well as the planned list. She indicates in the letter that she does all of the kinds of audits, I believe, that you need to do, financial, compliance, and performance audits. And we are not alone, as the previous previous testifier just mentioned. Multnomah County also has an elected auditor, as does the City of Portland and Washington County. Those are the ones that I know about. So The suggestion in this testimony is if this legislation is to go forward, to exempt those jurisdictions that have their own independently elected auditors from the section of the bill that deals with the fees and that sort of thing, section 2, subsection 1 of the bill as introduced. I did request that an amendment be drafted, and I got that back today. I believe it's been distributed to you. It's not quite right, and I've discussed it with legislative counsel, and it also amends the bill as introduced, as you know, rather than the bill that actually exists right now but hasn't been printed yet as amended by the dash ones. So happy to continue to fiddle with that and get it right if it's appropriate going forward, but I just wanted to make that brief comment and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Laurie, you want to go first?
Laurie Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. When this bill was sent out to the districts for fiscal impact, I got a tremendous amount of phone calls saying, what's going on? We billed and we're going to send for another audit. We too provide municipal audits, and I spoke with Co-Chair Holvey about what that does or doesn't provide for what you're looking for with this particular bill. So they appreciate the cap of the $7,500. However, we still would like every dollar to go into every construction project. And hopefully our public is looking at us saying that we do use our resources well. And I, too, agree with the previous speakers about we've got a work group going and see what that materializes and where this might fit in to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions? Representative Cameron first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Independent elected auditor. So they get on the ballot, run for the position?
That's correct.
What's the qualifications? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
The qualifications to be on the ballot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I'd have to go back and find out if you have to be a CPA. I know that our auditor is a CPA, and the previous one that was there for several years was a CPA. I don't know what the qualifications actually are. I think they probably are that you get more votes than the other person, but I'd be happy to, you know, get you a more specific answer.
That'd be good to know.
Yeah.
And follow-up, if I may.
Please.
So how often are they up for election?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, every 4 years in our case.
Is there a term limit?
I do know that our counselors have term limits, but I would have to check and see if the auditor has a term limit. I would imagine it's probably a three-term limit as the way our counselors are. Our council president has a two-term limit, so I'd be happy to get back to you about that.
That'd be good information to have. Thank you.
Qualifications. Thank you. And term limits. Okay, I'll get that for you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Have we thought, and there may be somebody else even better suited to answer this question, but have we thought about a potential amendment that would carve out local governments that had a certain kind of auditing practice already in place? And so essentially we would have a bill that had that set a floor of auditing practices that could be either met by whatever the local government was already doing, whatever they might do in the future, or if not, then the state auditing standard would go into effect, would be the standard.
I'm sorry. Is that a question for me?
Co-chairs,
Laurie Satinspiel again.
Yeah.
I think this is a perfect opportunity to talk about that in the work group.
Yeah. I should ask him about it. All right. Thanks.
Co-chair Helbig.
Thank you, and I appreciate the thought about discussing this in the work group. And one of the issues of the work group is looking at alternative bidding contracts, for example, shopping bids, those sorts of things. And one of the reasons for this was to provide the legislature some feedback about the issues with public contracts, so this work group could look at some audits around this, and that's why we put the sunset on this, thinking that it would help inform us. This is very, as a matter of fact, it's almost identical to the prevailing wage enforcement fund that is paid out of contracts. It doesn't come out of operational funds, as you know. It comes out of the contract just as if we were to implement a new law that required an extra fire sprinkler for safety. This is a bill that potentially provides some accountability and some oversight as to whether or not our contracting agencies are actually following the statutes of public contracting, and the state has a great deal of interest in that. We heard from a myriad of industry people this last session on this particular bill complaining about the rules being followed by agencies, including Portland, and including places where we have audits. And I've tried to look at some of the audits that have been provided to me from the city of Portland and some others, and nowhere I haven't found a specific audit on a construction project that actually delved into a particular issue that people have complained about. Do agencies follow the rules when it comes to making the findings to allow alternative contracting to take place? I haven't seen that. I'm curious, Mr. Tucker, when was the last audit of a public construction contract, and what contract was that that Portland did?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Holvey, I don't know about Portland because I represent Metro, I will note that in the testimony that you've received, there's commentary from our auditor about the audits that have been conducted already at the outset of our $125 million bond measure funded capital construction program at the Oregon Zoo. Mm-hmm. There was an audit done in advance of that construction program beginning that determined that we needed to get some better protections in place and better processes in place, and then there's been a follow-up audit that's been conducted in October of, I believe it says October of 2011 is when it was issued. So we're definitely tracking that. I'll have to find out if they're actually auditing the specific issue you mentioned about alternative contracting methods. I don't know the answer to that question, and I know that is one of the issues that caused this bill to come forward in the first place.
Yeah, it's one of many. I appreciate that, and like the prevailing wage enforcement fund, this bill's designed to protect the public's interest and also to make sure that we have a fair level playing field in the contracting world. And what we heard from industry is we do not, and we don't have a mechanism outside from the state level of really getting any feedback on what's happening. I appreciate the cities and counties being willing to share their information with us, and the type of audits they do don't necessarily, like at the community colleges, cover the specific issues that we're concerned with, is whether or not they're actually following the Attorney General's model public contracting laws. That is the issue that we're concerned about. And this bill, I thought, was relatively modest when you think of a $7,500 cap on a $100 million project. It doesn't seem like it's overly burdensome, and certainly would be less than requiring a fire sprinkler to protect the safety. Now we're trying to protect the investment of the public with a $7,500 cap on a big project, and just my point of view on it, but I appreciate that the counties and cities that already have independent auditors feel that they're covering this adequately. From what we've heard from industry, they don't feel that it's being covered adequately. So that's why we're in this situation. But anyway, thank you very much.
Any other questions, committee members? Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. I think we had Mr. Fuller. Would you like to come up and give us your clear, concise testimony, please?
Chairs and members of the committee, thanks for giving me the opportunity to come back. Your colleagues and the Judiciary Committee say hi. Darrell Fuller, on behalf of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors, by the way, much as the idea of being on another task force during the interim really thrills me, we kind of like the bill the way it is. We think it's, we've looked at the amendments. We have not, because of the nature of this session, had a legislative committee meeting for this association, but I did send out the bill and the amendments. All the responses I get back were favorable on both the bill and the amendments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, committee members?
Mr. Fuller, I'm just very curious. You may not know the answer to this. When the members of your association, you know, the have they expressed the need for this in areas that already do their own independent auditors, for instance, in Metro?
Co-Chair Holvey, I had more than one member specifically in their response say they thought it was a good idea. They didn't indicate a specific government entity that they were concerned about, but thought that it would be appropriate to have some additional oversight.
All right. Thank you. Thanks.
Well, thank you for your time.
Other questions? Mr. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. Have you thought of and what should be our best response to the protestation that there would be duplicative auditing and a mild or maybe not so mild mis-expenditure of resources?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, gut level reaction is the, you know, fox watching the phone, I guess. You have circumstances where you have somebody that works for an agency auditing what's going on in an agency. And I understand that auditors are independently elected in some cases. But the notion of, and I know with our association, we have an outside audit to come in and look at the books that somebody that is not as tied to yep. the organizations that's spending the money.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions, committee members? Representative Whitener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for me, I'm sitting here looking at it, the schools and things like that, and there you have your school board members, people that are elected to monitor the dollars quite closely, and they're held accountable when things go south. I'm just wondering what the need is, because I can see this affecting school budgets for any capital projects that they're doing. What's your feeling on that? Do you think they should be included in this? What's your reason for being behind this bill and really supportive of it? Has there been an issue where you've seen some bad actors or people doing the wrong thing with the money?
Co-Chair Representative Widener, I don't have any specific examples. I guess to the point that you made, I would assume if I were a school board member that I would want to watch those dollars carefully, so I would welcome information from an outside audit that I could review to make sure that things are being done properly. It's very difficult for a school board to maybe get into, especially a locally elected school board member, to have the expertise to get into the minutia and to be able to get to those results to determine whether or not money is being spent appropriately or not. So if I were on a budget committee or if I were, like I said, an elected school board member, I would think that outside audit would be welcome information.
Thank you. Other committee members' questions? Thank you, Mr. Fuller.
Thank you.
Let me see if Brian's out there. Let's get the vote on that.
He's out there.
Okay. That's all the members.
Did you say vote?
Yeah, I want to go back and vote on that bill. Get that on the record. Okay, committee members, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4115. Ladies and gentlemen, if anyone's here to waiting on House Bill 4131, we're going to be carrying that over to next Wednesday. Committee members, I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 4114. And give the other committee members an opportunity to vote on 4114. Representative Clem.
On 4114. Yeah, yes, I'm aye, thank you.
Wait a minute, actually, so we have to open the work session.
Good job, wasn't it?
And, Mr. Chair.
That's nice.
I would like to suspend the rules to allow Representative Clem to vote on House Bill 4114.
He'll just respond.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Aye.
Thank
you. Did you ask for any objection?
To suspend the rules.
Yeah. Objection to suspending the rules?
I don't have any.
Thank you. Representative
Thanks for asking.
And Representative Sheehan, your vote, please.
Yes.
So with that, we'll close the public work session on House Bill 4114. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4130. Jan, summarize the bill briefly, please.
Mm-hmm.
Summarize it briefly.
Yes.
Committee members, House Bill 4130 prohibits a contracting agency employee under some specified conditions and for a one-year period from being employed by a contractor with which the contracting agency entered into a public contract. Prohibits a contracting agency from awarding a contract to a bidder who will perform services outside of the country. Prohibits a contracting agency from accepting a bid from a bidder who advised the agency in preparing the solicitation documents or the materials related to the contract. It requires a bidder to make certain disclosures regarding prices and costs that they offer to provide on other federal, state, and local contracts. Permits the employee or the labor organization to seek a judicial review for any alleged violation of procurement requirements. Requires state agencies and education service districts to make certain information regarding public contracts available on the state's transparency website. Requires the OUS system to make solicitation documents available on the same system used by DAS to solicit contracts. Declares an emergency effective on passage. You have before you a Dash 1 amendment. This amendment deletes any provisions that would affect the Chapter 279C, the public construction contracting part of the contracting code.
Okay. Representative Kotek, do you want to come up and introduce your bill, please? Who else? Is Representative Kopp coming? Is she not coming?
She's coming. I believe so. I don't.
But thank you. Thank you. Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Good afternoon, colleagues. For the record, Representative Tina Kotek, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Co-Chair Holby, Co-Chair Wisnett. It's a real pleasure to be here today. Third day of session. We're all here still. Good to see you all. I'm really pleased that we have a chance to talk about this bill today. Like you, I hear from a lot of constituents about actually people all over the state who are concerned about how government is operating, worried about how we're spending our money here. And it's really important, given the fiscal situation we're in, that we do everything we can to be efficient and effective and really smart about how we spend our money, particularly if we're going to protect the services that we need most, schools, programs for seniors, maintaining public safety. And in the last year or so, we've heard stories that have, you know, put those questions in people's mind about what kind of job we're doing here, scrutinizing what we do in terms of public contracting. And it really became apparent from some of these stories that we don't have all the tools we need to make sure the public contracting is going as appropriately as possible. Examples, last spring there was a Department of Administrative Services employee who had left the agency and then immediately turned around and had a consulting contract. I think those kind of stories raise eyebrows among our constituents. Another story that we heard recently, the fees in the contract we have at U.S. Bank for the Relia card for unemployment benefits were dramatically higher than in other states. And in that particular instance, Treasurer Wheeler was able to renegotiate that contract. But we don't know how many instances of those other types of issues are happening here in the state. The bottom line is the legislature and the public don't always have access to the information we need to know who is being paid for what, how we compare with contracts in other states. And that's why we're here today with House Bill 4130, a bill that I believe has bipartisan support and interest. It's badly needed to make sure that government is contracting is transparent, and to frankly build confidence among Oregonians that we're spending their money wisely. So House Bill 4130 would reform government contracting and improve scrutiny and transparency by doing several things. It would prohibit outsourcing contracts overseas, giving preference to companies that create jobs at home. It would remove unfair advantages that in a request for proposal, writers who would have access to bidding on a contract keep them from actually writing the bid specs. It would talk about requiring bidders or contractors to be transparent about the terms of similar contracts in other states. So if a contractor comes here and they have a contract with three other states, we have a sense of where we are in the ballpark, for example, you know, too high, too low, giving the state and Oregonians the information they need to make good choices and negotiate and with all the information on the table. This bill would close the revolving door that allows state employees to work for the state one day and then turn around and accept a contract for the same job at the same agency the next. But since right now we don't have the oversight or accountability we need around that type of situation. And lastly, the bill updates our transparency and contracting laws to ensure accountability and further encourage savings and oversight. I know from while the session's moving quickly, I've heard there are some concerns about specific components of the bill. I'm very open to suggestions and adjustments. You know, state government's very complex. We want to make sure that we are allowing for certain things that would make some sense that this law would somehow make impossible to do. But I do believe it's critically important to work together and to move this bill as soon as possible. So I hope you share the urgency about the situation around public contracting that I do that led to the drafting of this bill and to make sure that we are making sure that there are no sweetheart contracts to taxpayers or for ones the taxpayers should be worried about. That's costing them money. We need oversight and accountability, and that's what this bill is about. Because at the end of the day, students, parents, law enforcement, seniors, they're all counting on us to spend our money wisely and to have appropriate oversight of how we do business here. And I hope you'll be as interested as I am in working together to make this bill just right and get it going as soon as we can. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We'll wait and let Representative Comp, would you please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony on this bill, please?
Yes. After hearing just a little bit, anyway, Representative Betty Comp, House District 22, and I am here today to support House Bill 4130, and for many of the exact reasons that Leader Kotek just mentioned. Ever since I've been here, I have looked for efficiencies in our government systems, and so that we can provide those services to our children. As you all know, as my colleagues, that education is my top priority. And the amount of dollars that have gone, the percentage amount of dollars of education in the past 10 years has diminished. And I know that happens in business the same way. This bill is to help businesses get the best contracts that they can get. And in that process, hopefully they're saving agency dollars and so that they can be more innovative with those dollars themselves. And again, cost savings. This is an important bill. That transparency that we started with in last session with our legislation, this is another step to that. And I don't know if Leader Kotek shared this example, but the example I have, in 2005, a former employee at ODOT helped their potential employer receive a $5.3 million state contract right before they resigned from ODOT. And so by putting this space of time in between working for an agency and giving out a contract that, yeah, you don't have a worker procuring his next career advancement is the way I would put it nicely. And so with that, I ask for your support. And again, we are working, as all of you are, to the best opportunity to help our businesses have the information they need to make good contracts and good decisions. Thank you, and please vote aye and move it to the floor.
Thank you very much for both of your testimony. I'd like to point out to both of my colleagues that this is our first committee hearing, and we did bring this bill forward for the public hearing in the first bill. Questions of these honorable colleagues?
Mr. Chair.
Let's start with Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This could be either one of you, but have we had a legal opinion on this? Because
5 minutes is all we have.
You're basically saying to somebody they get laid off or resign that they can't go to work for a public company if they do business with the state. And I'm just wondering, because even with a non-compete clause, you can't keep somebody from working. And there's laws against this. So I'm just wondering if you've hit LC for a legal opinion on whether or not this is legal. And my second question to it would be, why didn't we put put elected officials in there for taking government jobs after a session as well.
We did that last night.
Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Winder, thank you for the question. You know, in asking Legislative Council to draft this, I always assume that they'll let me know if we're somehow outside of constitutional bounds. We did try to make, in terms of the revolving door issue, it calls for a waiting period. It doesn't say they could not then go work for the contractor. If a state employee, for example, says, I'm leaving and then I would eventually like to come back as a consultant, it just requires a waiting period, which I think from just a public perception thing is a good thing. So I am familiar with non-compete clauses. I don't think we have a problem with a waiting period. We're not saying you couldn't come back and do it. There just has to be a waiting time. I know there's been legislation for representatives. We're not contractors. I think that's a somewhat separate issue. But again, that called for a waiting period. So I think that was an alignment. And I'm sorry, the second question about...
You got the second part of it, but my concern is actually state employees who retire and basically are double coming back to the state and double dipping that way would be a bigger concern to me than them going to the private sector. And are we addressing that in this at all?
No, that's a different.
Yeah, Co-Chair Wisnett and Representative Widener, you know, there are several pretty extensive statutes of how we deal with individuals who retire and the limits on which they can come back into public employment, and this doesn't deal with any of those statutes. But
follow up on that?
Yes. Committee members, too, just for your information, when I was in the committees, we do have other people from DAS speaking, from the unions and the cities and contractors on this. So our colleagues here, you don't have to be too rough on this. So, yeah.
And by far, they're the experts, as we all know.
Yes, please follow up.
Well, this one would be appropriate for the people who have the bill here. Would you be open for amendments to gather some of those things that are outside the web coming into this bill with employment to cover the double dipping where you have a professor who retires at $100,000 a year and he's going back and substituting and working in classrooms still making another $50,000 at the college?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Widener, with the relating clause relating to public contracting, I don't think we can bring up... touch on that because that's a different topic, but I understand your concern, but really it's a different context in this bill. So
Greg, did you have a question? Representative Matthews,
just applaud their efforts.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sheehan.
Representative Holvey does.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Comp, you mentioned a example, and thank you for bringing that, and it sounds really suspicious. I'm wondering if is this response in response to sort of a suspicion about that, or was there any action taken afterwards to find out if they were a less qualified contractor or if there was any anything nefarious that was happening? I think it's sort of reasonable in looking at the overall scope of the state to say maybe if you had a working relationship with someone and you were jumping ship to work in the private sector that could happen from time to time. Do you know if there was anything found to be wrong that was done there?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Sheehan, I would have to go back and get more details and get back to you if I might.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure. Any other questions? Co-Chair Hobie?
Thank you. I really just wanted to extend my appreciation for bringing this bill forward. I think there is a big issue involved with some of the service contracts that we deal with, but I do want to clarify that I have asked for an amendment that deletes Section 8 that I think I mentioned to you for the record, which deals with 279C, which is the public construction part, and this bill causes some severe problems with that section of law, and we have this ongoing work group on construction to try to deal with issues involved with that. So it's a little bit unique, and just wanted to, you know, let you know that would be this chair's contention that section be deleted out of the bill too. So I'm certain we can have a further conversation about that as a committee and as members as well.
Thank you. Other committee members' questions? Thank you both for bringing forth this bill. And site good
thank
weekend.
Thank you. Thanks
site
for hearing it. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask Ms. Diane Lancaster and Sean McSpaden. Is that correct? Welcome. Good afternoon. Please give us your name for the record and concise, clear, concise testimony.
Thank you. Co-Chair Wisnant and Co-Chair Holvey, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, and I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services for the State Procurement Office. I'm here today to speak briefly on 4130, and I'm addressing the Dash 1 version, which does contain the amended language that Representative Holvey just referred to. We had just a couple of items that were a little unclear about the intent, or we believe the detail might create difficulties in implementation. And I would just remark on Section 5, this is the area of no unfair bidder or proposer advantage allowed due to prior service or advice. It is not the employee piece. It is about contractors who have provided prior advice or assistance to a contracting agency on the subject of the solicitation. So we are dealing just with outside contracting people. And I would just ask, we're a little unclear about the intent of this particular section. The policy of the code in 279A is pretty clear, and we, of course, vigorously support ethical practice in contracting. There is current language in 279B.210 that I would just refer to because it seems to offer very similar advice and direction about contractors engaging in helping to prepare solicitation or other materials. So there's just a bit of lack of clarity there. And then subsection 6, this is the section that talks about bidders and proposers to provide the comparison data around the goods or services that they offer and the comparison data across other state, federal, and local lines. The language as it currently is drafted is a mandatory obligation for bidders and proposers to provide this and it's rather extensive disclosure of price, rate, and total cost for similar goods and services provided at any level of government, and it's across all states, not just Oregon, so it is a national level disclosure. Under 279B and the way it's currently stated, this would apply to everything. All goods, all services, including professional services that are covered in this particular code area. And that might be fine. There is, though, a mandatory bid or proposal rejection feature. There are no exceptions if a bidder fails to disclose any of this information. It's tight. There's not any flexibility for the agency to determine when it would be advantageous to ask for this kind of information. So we're just a little concerned about that and whether that would get in the way of implementation. Bidders may be being reluctant or unable to provide sufficient information, potentially standing there with their proposal and the agency then being mandated to reject what might otherwise be a good offer. So that was the only concern we had. And with that, we did feel that there would be enough workload impact on the system that it could create a workload and potentially a fiscal impact from that Section 6 language. So with that, I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. McSpadden, is that correct? Spadden?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean McSpadden. I serve as Oregon's Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and I'm here today to talk with you about some background related to the Oregon Transparency Law, ORS 184.483, and Section 9 of House Bill 4130, which proposes several amendments or changes to the Oregon Transparency Law. Among other things, Section 9 of House Bill 3140 requires that information that's posted on the site be in a downloadable format that can be read by commonly used software applications. We don't have concerns in that area because we fundamentally believe that the information provided on the site is provided in formats that are accessible by the predominant software applications that are out there, and also there are at least half a dozen file formats that are available to users of the site. So that portion of the bill does not concern us. We have questions and concerns from a fiscal perspective about two other areas of the bill. Section 9, among other things, requires that the information on the transparency website be updated twice each calendar year and at least four times each biennium. Currently, the Oregon Transparency website is updated once annually, and in part, that annual update is was the cycle that the bill sponsors at the time of House Bill 2500 in the 2009 legislative session chose because they had a concern about ongoing fiscal impact both to the Department of Administrative Services and the agency boards and commissions that had to provide the information to us for posting. And so we have some concerns in that area. The last area involves enhanced tax expenditure information and posting of more detailed contracting and subcontracting information. Because of the number of entities involved, the fact that even within state government, there is not a single contracting system that's utilized by all agencies. I believe there are dozens, if not up to 100, specific exemptions that are currently granted in statute to state agency boards and commissions regarding their own contracting authority. It's very difficult to collect that information in a timely manner, even on an annual basis, much less on a period that is more frequent than that. At a high level, again, to step back, House Bill 2500 in the 2009 legislative session required that our department, the Department of Administrative Services, stand up and maintain and update Oregon's transparency website, and required state agency boards and commissions to provide a variety of information related to their budgets, expenditures, staff salary information, contracts, and the like, to our department for posting. Again, the law itself explicitly states that those efforts are to be conducted to the extent practicable and subject to laws relating to confidentiality when at no additional cost, using existing data and existing state agency resources, and without reallocation of resources. So that's really the major constraint that we've dealt with since 2009. We've tried to make enhancements each year to the site within our own resources, within the resources of agency boards and commissions. And now, subsequent to changes in the 2011 legislative session, the transparency law now covers education service districts. It covers payments to counties, lottery payments to counties, and their tracking of that information. It also requires all agency boards and commissions and education service districts to post notices of public meetings via our department on the transparency website. And so we've had, over the last 3 years, a cumulative effect that is quickly reaching, if not has already reached, a fiscal impact on our department, on agencies, now local governments, and education service districts. And so additional requirements in those areas that I mentioned within House Bill 4130 are of concern. Tried to make my testimony brief. In short, we welcome the opportunity to work with the bill sponsors to identify ways that we can accomplish the purpose the bill sponsors have in mind without incurring these potential, and to be frank, indeterminate fiscal impacts at this time. But we're just tapped out, frankly, and we have a real concern that a requirement for additional information from those entities without significant automation being in place, you know, single procurement systems, integrated procurement finance and budget systems being in place, it's really a manual process for the most part. So
thank you very much. Representative Smith, and I appreciate all you've done and the transparency. I think the taxpayers and citizens of Oregon also thank you for all you've done. Do you have a list of this that you could provide, or are you going to work with the bill drafters to be sure that we can look at this? And I see that Representative Kotek still with us, and maybe these areas sure need to be looked at, or otherwise it...
Co-Chair Wisnant, we'd be glad to work with the bill sponsors, and certainly have, as you know, we've appreciated our ability to work with you all, and transportation, the Transparency Advisory Commission that we all work with, we've appreciated that opportunity, and would be glad to work with the bill sponsors on
thank
this.
You. Thank you. Committee members, questions? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'll repeat the thank you, sort of perma-thanks. The And the purpose of the site, of course, was to share information that we've got, right? And right. My hope would be, and the argument then, the argument now is, I understand that as we're cutting budgets, it's hard to add staff to gather information, but what can we do to share information that we've got? But it does seem to me, I would hope that some of this stuff is stuff that we are, in fact, getting. I would hope that contract information is the problem that we're not getting it, or is that we're getting it and we just don't have a way to gather it easily.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Smith, I think it's the latter. As an example, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, the Oregon Public Interest Research Group, annually rates transparency sites across the nation and within Oregon. And one of the areas that has been most problematic for us is the provision of the actual contract, as an example. We have the actual contracts. For the most part, they exist in paper files. Some of them are posted on the Oregon Procurement Information Network and other procurement systems that other agencies in the university systems or the mm-hmm. Department of Transportation might administer, but they're not all available in one place, nor are all the contracts available in one place, as an example. Mm-hmm. But rest assured, they do exist. They are being kept and maintained. They're just not accessible. They're not in an accessible form. I think the same thing could be said for much of the information in the other areas, expenditures, mm-hmm. budgets, mm-hmm. Performance information. We have it. It just isn't in a format or in systems that can be integrated and easily provided to the public. Some of the other states, as you know, Representative Smith, that have been able to do that have systems called enterprise resource planning systems. At times, they can cost up to $100, $200, $300 million to put in place, but they are integrated. They do allow for the real-time access of information of this kind.
Follow up. Thanks, Mr. Chair. The hope, and there might be various ideas. Maybe we put something in the bill that says by blank date we'll get to there, because the hope is, and we haven't communicated as much, but I have. The hope is that rather than thinking of merely another set of tasks, rather we can think that sharing the most important elements of what we do as a government with the people who run the government, which are supposed to be the people, is how we think about how we get our work done. Right? It's not. Hopefully, it's not merely another bureaucratic step to take, but it's just this is what we do because we serve the people. Right? We don't serve the agencies; the agencies serve us. All of us serve everybody else. In terms of moving towards more than annually, because we're moving towards systems that don't require, somebody in a green eye shade asking, do you have the following papers in a manila envelope and I will retype them, and then post them on a window and somebody, roughly moving towards automated system, what do we think it's going to take to get to a place where it just sort of feels like standard operating procedure? You do things and it's easy to share and it's not that hard and, how long do we think that's going to take?
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Smith, I don't have an immediate answer for you. It's complicated, mm-hmm. partly because of all of the various entities that are involved. As an example, during this update, we work with over 80 individual state agencies, with 36 counties, with 19 education service districts, with multiple portions of the Oregon University systems. Mm-hmm. And so just the sheer number of entities that have independent authority and need to be consulted in order to ensure that we have the right information, that it's accurate, and that it's accessible is just a challenge. I think what we're saying is that with House Bill 4130 and or any other bill that would add additional requirements, it just is at a point where it's going to require some investments. To date, we've gotten as far as we can, or as far as we have, within existing resources. And it's just we're at a point where, again, at this point, without really analyzing the bill or talking with all of those entities, we haven't come up with a specific fiscal impact, but we do believe there is one that's indeterminate at this time.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two quick questions. Do we use any type of enterprise system right now? No J.D. Edwards, no J.D. Edwards, One World, Maximo, SAP. We're not using any type of enterprise system is what you're telling me.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Widener, I think actually it's the converse. We have many of those systems. We don't just use one. So as an example, the Department of Corrections does utilize J.D. Edwards One World. The Department of Transportation is currently utilizing a 25 to 30-year-old mainframe-based system called TEAMS. The Department of Administrative Services for about 80 state agencies utilizes a system called RSTARS that was put in place in the mid-90s. So that's really our challenge, is that we have multiple systems. There is no single system of record, no single system, other than at a summary level. RSTARS is the summary level system of record. However, the detail of the transactions are held in some of these individual agency systems. So that's the challenge that we have, and we haven't yet as a state been at a point where we could either afford or have the political will or ability to implement a single J.D. Edwards or an Oracle SAP type enterprise resource planning system.
Next one that will pertain more to what I think they're trying to get at with this bill here is, what kind of bid requirements do we have for a project? Because is it just one bid, or do we require that there must be three bids? What's the bid procedure for a project? Because I know when I do projects with different people, I'll take out three or four guys, show them the job, show them exactly what I want, and then they come in and they have to meet the qualifications, and usually goes to the lowest bidder of the three or four that I get. Do we have any requirements on the bid process for a project?
Excuse me, co-chairs and Representative Widener, I'm sorry. Yes, the Public Procurement Code lays out a lot of requirements about when you must go out for full public open competitive solicitation. Generally, the rule of thumb is that at $150,000 for any ordinary goods or services or professional projects like information technology, you must publish an open competition, and it is to be out on the public noticing availability for at least a month and widely broadcast. The Oregon Procurement Information System, which the Department of Administrative Services operates, currently has over 55,000 vendors, over 80% of which are Oregon addresses, who are constantly working and looking at that system. In construction, it is the same thing, although there are some different dollar values, and I believe in construction it's like any project over $100,000 must be publicly noticed. You don't always know how many bids or proposals you receive, but the goal and the policy of the Public Procurement Code, which this legislature has created, is to maximize competition to the absolute maximum extent possible. So that's the general nature of the outreach and levels.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up?
Yes, please.
Is there any way that an employee could game that? And would it be legal for him to game it to get somebody a bid? Because that's kind of what they're trying to get at here. And if the situation is right with $5 million and getting a job, if there was collusion going on there, I believe that's illegal already in statute, and they could go to prison for that.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, yes, absolutely. Collusion, bid rigging, fraudulent practice, all of these, bid shopping, all of these things have levels of illegality that ultimately get to criminal activity. And certainly one can easily go back quickly in the annals of even this state, which has a good record, and see incidents where someone did something like that and ultimately did do jail time or prison time. And so it does happen. There is a group at the Department of Justice that deals with these kinds of fraudulent activities, and anyone may call them and under confidentiality and may report anything they are concerned about in the public contracting arena, and they will investigate completely separate of any other. So there are some safeguards. Of course, people need to know how to use them, clearly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hovey.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and your candor at looking at the bill. And I have two questions, and Mr. Chair, if I could start with the first one, is I'm curious on the transparency website. You mentioned these other systems and other agencies that have, you know, transparency websites of their own, which are not necessarily symbiotic with yours. Does the transparency website currently have links to those other agency websites?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Holvey. Just a quick point of clarification. In the state of Oregon, only have one transparency website that I'm aware of, but we have multiple financial systems, procurement systems, budget systems behind the scenes. So that's really the issue I was talking about. In terms of information that agencies post on their websites, absolutely. I think, Representative Smith, you'd agree, a good part of the, I'll call it the non-core information that we have posted out on the Oregon Transparency website is a link to another agency system or another agency website. A key example would be one of the original requirements of House Bill 2500 required that audits by the Secretary of State be posted on the Transparency website. The fact is Secretary of State already has an automated system available on their own website where you can go and search for audits of not only state agencies but local governments, education service districts. So the approach that we took was to simply provide a link to that system. We've done the same thing with the OSTAR campaign contribution site, many others. So yes, that we take that approach whenever where we can. Recently, we just took that approach with local government information. We, in partnership with Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities, we were made aware that many of Oregon cities already post at least their budget information, if not contract information. City of Albany has a great transparency dashboard site of its own, so we do have a page for local government information on the site in our resources section.
How about the OUS system?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Holvey, we, in terms of the OUS system, Oregon University Systems was one of the entities within House Bill 2500 that were compelled to report to us. They've done so each biennium. In each of the primary areas, staff salaries, I believe we have about 15,000 or so records on site, contracts, expenditures, et cetera. And this time around, even though
Have a link to it, was what I was getting.
We do. With Senate Bill 242, even with the passage of that bill, they voluntarily have begun to post meeting notices on site. So we have a great relationship with them.
Thank you. And the final thing, I know you both mentioned some specific issues. You've been through the bill about fiscal impacts and some troublesome spots in the bill that you think need to be addressed. And I know the chair asked you to work with the sponsors of the bill, but I would like to ask you to work with this co-chair anyway in expediting your suggestions to get rid of the fiscal impact. And I'm hoping you can get that to us like Monday, if possible, to give us your suggestions on how to make the bill such a shape that you won't have a big fiscal burden that we need to deal with. Okay. That's pretty important.
Certainly.
I would appreciate that.
Co-chairs, Holvey, I'll be glad to. The one area, we only have this one area, and I think I could suggest something, and I will get it to both offices.
Thank you.
We'll do the same.
Thank you.
Question, Representative Cameron?
Thank you. Just in, I guess it's on page 3A, and I just want to make sure that I'm clear at second line, shall require a bidder or proposer to disclose in a bid or proposal the price rate, cost of goods or services. Does that mean what the cost is to the state, or does that mean the cost of goods or services that the person is making the bid?
Co-Chair Wisniewski and Holvey, Representative Cameron, this is frankly where I start getting a little bit confused myself. It goes on to talk about the nature of the comparison and talking about that are similar to the goods or services described in the solicitation document and specifications. So that word similar, clearly from state to state, I don't know that. Certainly a bidder in this state, I would expect to provide a bid or a proposal that is absolutely on point with this state's requirements or a state agency's requirements. That particular language, I'm not totally sure how an agency. In many situations, we do a fair amount of research. We do cross comparisons because we want to find out what other states are paying, what other entities are paying. And in fact, we have a key performance measure that this legislature authorized many years ago that we do a market basket comparison routinely to see how our pricing on ordinary goods and services is faring. But in a specific bidding or proposal situation, the concern is that the same as the offer they're making to us? I don't know how it could be given the language as it currently lays out, because it talks about the similarity and, you know, the other entities. So again, I'm a little confused myself.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, committee members. I think appreciate your testimony. I think we brought up some good issues. This is a complicated issue, and this is our first public hearing. I think there's some things we want to do. I'm not sure how the session is going to go here. I have two people in favor of it, Mr. Sisk and Ms. Is it Elena Gilliatt? Is that pronounced? Please come up and give us your name and your concise, clear testimony, please.
Co-Chair Hobley, Co-Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Sisk. I'm an employee with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm a member of SEIU 503 and president of Sublocal 125. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 4130. As SEIU discussed in our first Moving Oregon Forward report, state employees represent about 18% of Oregon state budget expenditures of state funds. That's $7.4 billion, while contracts account for roughly 16%. That's $6.9 billion. We also found that the budget for contracts has expanded by 10% per year since 2007, even as services for Oregonians have been cut during hard fiscal times. Efforts to balance the budget must therefore consider the cost of contracting out. Efforts must be made to ensure that citizens maintain control of and receive the best value for every contract dollar, and HB 4130 can help. And here's how. HB 4130 has several pieces. First, the bill requires a one-year cooling-off period. A recent former employee of a state agency must wait 1 year before he or she seeks or gains employment with a contractor with which the state agency contracted with. The one-year cooling off period applies if the former employee worked on matters related to the public contract or in a field closely related to the public contract. And I think you've heard already the example of the ODOT employee who was previously employed by an environmental services firm and then helped work a $5.3 million contract with that firm and went as an ODOT employee and then went back to work for that firm. By the way, I think there was a question. There's an audit report with the details which we can get to the committee if the committee so desires. The bill also protects public dollars and holds contractors accountable as follows in the responsible bidding part. Contractors involved in drafting a request for proposal, scope of work, or other material related to procurement are barred from bidding on that procurement if they would have an advantage in obtaining the public contract. An example is in 2011, a contractor worked with the Department of Revenue evaluating systems in a process before creating a business plan for the core system replacement RFP. When the RFP was released, that same contractor bid for and won the bid. Initially, the contractor later lost the bid to an unrelated issue. Another element of HB 4130 is the right to know. State agencies shall require information about similar services providing in other jurisdictions, and bidders for public contracts must provide that information. You've heard of the example of the U.S. Bank, which recently made headlines for charging excessive fees under terms of this RelyCard contract. And an analysis of similar debit card services by the National Consumer Law Center found that other states had far more favorable terms, even with U.S. Bank. So Oregon Treasurer Ted Wheeler was able to renegotiate and approve that U.S. Bank contract. The bill also expands enforcement mechanism in the contracting code with another provision that would be judicial review. If a contracting agency violates a provision within the contracting code and a judicial remedy is not otherwise available, the violation is subject to judicial review. This bill expands the enforcement mechanism in the contracting code to an employee group or labor organization representing the employer group when all administrative remedies have been exhausted. Currently, only another would-be contractor can seek relief under the contracting code. For example, the city of Wilsonville recently contracted out the wastewater treatment plant without performing a feasibility study as required by ORS Chapter 279B. The city argued that since they were entering into a design, build, and operate contract with a single contractor, ORS Chapter 279B did not apply, and capital construction is governed by ORS Chapter 297C.
I am very, very sorry, but we have to vacate this hearing room. So your support is, you're supporting the bill, and I appreciate all those examples. We may ask you to give us those in writing, but we're going to.
Yes, we have this. So thank you very much. If you can summarize.
Thank you.
Sure. Would you like me to sum up?
Please, if you got a statement or something.
Basically, we just think that this bill is in the interest of protecting public dollars and making sure that things are, the expenditures are done appropriately and without any kind of malfeasance or any kind of inefficiency in spending. And we can
Thank you for your testimony. If you want to give us those, you know, some examples, but I think, you know, we're going to try to hear real quickly from those in a proposition.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnik, Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I am not going to go over all of the reasons that we support this bill. You've heard them from others. I do want to clarify one section that I have heard a few concerns about, and that is Section 3. The intent of this section is to ensure that contracted work is not moving jobs from Oregon to overseas. And I know that a few people have raised concerns that there are jobs that must be performed by people overseas, things like helping to promote Oregon businesses, recruit employers to Oregon. Our intent in the language in this bill, and when we have talked to a few of you about language similar to this in the past, was not to hurt the agencies that need those jobs. Where there are needs overseas, we're happy to work with people to fix the language. Where those people working overseas could be state employees and subject to the various ethics laws and other requirements of state employment, I think that might be a simple solution, but as they need to be contractors, we're happy to find a way to make that work within this language while still ensuring that we're not moving jobs from Oregon to overseas, which is what we want to
stop. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're going to have to bring this back, or we'll have to do some more work on this bill. I'd like to bring up, we have the last three panels. Thank you very much for being here, and I apologize again for rushing.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee.
Okay, real quick, we have, if you can give us your positions, Mr. Hagendorf, Mr. Eiselman, and Mike Ellison. Ellison, I apologize.
Clearly, chief pronunciator.
Yeah, if you can just sort of summarize, we're going to, like I said, this is going to take, the bill's going to take some more work, I think it's, if you can really quickly summarize, sure. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Co-Chair Wisnik, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, again, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. We agree with some of the broad themes that have been stated by Representative Kotek and proponents of the bill. Definitely would like to address some of those broad themes. We're a little concerned that some of the language in the bill doesn't necessarily get to some of those concerns that were addressed. So I agree with some of the concerns raised by the Department of Administrative Services. Really quickly, I'll I'll just focus on one section that hasn't been talked about, Section 2. A little concerned from a HR perspective of how that would work. Say if an employee leaves a public agency and wants to go work for a private consulting firm, let's say a private firm basically says you have to sit out a year before you work on anything related to the kind of work that the state and the consulting firm are involved in together. We're in an era of downsizing. We have folks who are not necessarily, who are frankly being laid off, and they would probably naturally want to go pursue work with the kind of firms that may do business with the state. We're not sure how that would be administered. And then following that, Section 2.2 then says, but if the public agency can't perform the service, needs to contract it out, that private firm must, is required to offer employment at the exact same or at least similar employment terms as the public employee that was performing the service. We have some questions of how that would be administered, and again, certainly agree with some of the themes, but I'll have some issues with some of the language that's in the bill itself.
Thank you very much. Drew, you'd please identify.
Thank you, co-chairs, committee members. Drew Hagedorn, appearing today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're testifying in opposition to the underlying bill of House Bill 4130, at least as it's currently composed. I understand from your comments, Co-Chair Holvey, that there is a Dash 1 amendment that seeks to remove from the bill's scope its application to ORS Chapter 279C. We would invite that, and that would bring us to neutral. I presume that that probably entails the removal of Section 6. While I haven't seen the Dash 1 amendments, we'll take a look at those. In addition, I'd like to make a comment for the record that ORS Chapter 279A applies both to Subchapter B, which is public procurements, and Subchapter C, which is public improvements. It's a general provisions that apply both to both chapters, and so we want to make sure that there were no unintended consequences of the changes that would be made to A on Subchapter C. So with that, we'll close. Certainly, many of you participated and had a role in forming the Public Contracting Code Coalition that's looking at changes for to Subchapter C for the 2013 session. We think this kind of conversation would be probably appropriate for that forum. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I apologize again, Mr. Eisenman.
Thank you, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Esselman on behalf of the Oregon University System. We are testifying in opposition to the university system's inclusion in Section 10 of the bill. We believe that would put us into the ORPIN system for procurement. We are not governed, pursuant to a law passed by this assembly in 1995, we are not governed by the public contracting code. We put all of our business and bid opportunities up on our homepage. You'll see with one click you get to the various categories of bids that are available. Actually, if we were to go under ORPIN, you would see only registered vendors can access bids under ORPIN. So we believe this would put procurement opportunities further away from the public rather than closer, and that's not something we want to see happen. Furthermore, in terms of the transparency website, as you heard from DAS, we've been working closely with them. We've been completing reports that we're actually no longer required to complete with the effectiveness of Senate Bill 242, but we will continue those. And I had an opportunity to speak briefly with Democratic Leader Kotek in the back of the room here. We are certainly willing to link our site anywhere that it's useful, but what we don't want to do is have to meet the various requirements of ORPIN, which are driven by statute ORS 279, which doesn't apply to us. We have our own set of rules, so it would create a duplication of effort and redundancy that we think is unnecessary.
Thank you both.
We have an amendment, incidentally, the Dash 2s.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I apologize for the rush, and we'll be addressing this again. Committee members, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4130, and we'll close the House General Government and Consumer Protection Committee. Thank you.
Sorry.